Abiamus!
The hand hastily withdrew, and the footsteps hurried away. His earpiece had translated none of it because it was turned off. He had to rely on his Latin. What was pestilentia? Probably plague. The soldiers had seen the mark on the door and had quickly moved away. Jesus, he thought, was this a plague house? Is that why it had been burned down? Could you still catch the plague? He was wondering about this when, to his horror, a black rat scuttled out of the deep grass and away through the door. Chris shivered. Kate awoke and yawned. What time is... He pressed his finger to her lips and shook his head. He heard the men still moving away, their voices faint in the gray morning. Chris slid out from under the shed, crept to the window, and looked out cautiously. He saw at least a dozen soldiers all around them wearing the green and black colors of Arnaud. The soldiers were methodically checking all the thatched cottages near the monastery walls. As Chris watched, he saw Merrick walking toward the soldiers. Merrick was hunched over, dragging one leg. He carried some greens in his hands. The soldiers stopped him. Merrick bowed obsequiously. His whole body seemed small, weak-looking. He showed the soldiers what was in his hand. The soldiers laughed and shoved him aside. Merrick walked on, still hunched and deferential. Kate watched Merrick walk past their burnt-out farmhouse and disappear around behind the monastery wall. He obviously wasn't going to come to them while the troops were still there. Chris had crawled back under the shed, wincing. His shoulder seemed to be hurt. There was dried blood on the fabric. She helped him unbutton his doublet, and he screwed up his face and bit his lip. Gently, she pulled aside his loose-necked linen undershirt, and she saw that the entire left side of his chest was an ugly purple with a yellowish-black tinge at the edges. That must be where he had been hit by the lance. Seeing the look on her face, he whispered, "Is it bad?" "I think it's just a bruise. Maybe some cracked ribs. Hurts like hell." She slid the shirt over his shoulder, exposing the arrow cut. It was a slanting 2-inch tear across the skin surface, caked with dried blood.
"How is it?"
he said, watching her face.
"Just a cut."
"Infected?"
"No, it looks clean."
She pulled the doublet down farther, saw more purple bruising on his back and his side, beneath his arm. His whole body was one big bruise. It must be incredibly painful. She was amazed that he wasn't complaining more. After all, this was the same guy who threw fits if he was served dried sep mushrooms instead of fresh ones in his morning omelet, who could pout if he didn't like the choice of wine. She started to button his doublet up for him. He said, "I can do that."
"I'll help you.
I said I can do it." She pulled away, held her palms up.
"Okay, okay."
"I have to get these arms moving anyway," he said, wincing with each button. He did them all by himself. But afterward, he sat back against the wall, eyes closed, sweating from the exertion and the pain.
"Chris?"
He opened his eyes. "I'm fine, really. Don't worry about me. I'm perfectly fine." And he meant it. She almost felt as if she were sitting next to a stranger. When Chris had seen his shoulder and chest, it was the purple color of dead meat. His own reaction had surprised him. The injury was severe. He expected to feel horrified or frightened, but instead he felt suddenly light, almost carefree. The pain might be making him gasp for breath, but the pain didn't matter. He just felt glad to be alive and facing another day. His familiar complaints, his cavils and uncertainties seemed suddenly irrelevant. In their place, he discovered that he had some source of boundless energy, an almost aggressive vitality that he could not recall ever experiencing before. He felt it flowing through his body, a kind of heat. The world around him seemed more vivid, more sensuous than he could remember before. To Chris, the gray dawn took on a pristine beauty. The cool, damp air bore a fragrance of wet grass and damp earth. The stones against his back supported him. Even his pain was useful because it burned away all unnecessary feeling. He felt stripped down, alert, and ready for anything. This was a different world, with different rules. And for the first time, he was in it. Totally in it. When the troops had gone, Merrick returned. "Did you understand all that?" he said.
"What?"
"The soldiers are searching for three people from Castelgar, two men and a woman."
"Why?"
"Arnaud wants to talk to them." "Isn't it nice to be popular?" Chris said with a wry smile. "Everyone's after us." Merrick gave them each a handful of wet grass and leaves. "Field greens. That's breakfast. Eat up." Chris chewed the plants noisily.
"Delicious," he said. He meant it.
"The plant with the jagged leaves is feverfew. It'll help with the pain. The white stalk is willow. Reduce your swelling."
"Thanks," Chris said. "It's very good."
Merrick was staring at him in disbelief. He said to Kate, "Is he okay?"
"Actually, I think he's fine."
"Good. Eat up, and then we'll go to the monastery. If we can get past the guards."
Kate pulled off her wig.
"That won't be a problem," she said. "They're looking for two men and a woman. So, who's got the sharpest knife?"
Fortunately, her hair was already short. It took only a few minutes for Merrick to cut away the longer strands and finish the job. While he worked, Chris said,
"I've been thinking about last night."
"Obviously, somebody's got an earpiece," Merrick said.
"Right," Chris said, "and I think I know where they got it."
"Gomez," Merrick said.
Chris nodded. "That's my guess. You didn't take it from her?"
"No, I didn't think to."
"I'm sure another person could push it far enough into his own ear to hear it, even if it doesn't really fit him."
"Yes," Merrick said, "but the question is, who? This is the 14th century. A pink lump that talks in little voices is witchcraft. It'd be terrifying to anyone who found it. Whoever picked it up would drop it like a hot potato, and then crush it immediately, or run like mad."
"I know," Chris said. "That's why every time I think about it, I can see only one possible answer."
Merrick nodded. "Those bastards didn't tell us."
"Tell us what?" Kate said.
"That there's somebody else back here. Somebody from the 20th century."
"It's the only possible answer," Chris said.
"But who?"
Kate said. Chris had been thinking about that all morning. "Decare," he said. "It's got to be Decare."
Merrick was shaking his head.
"Consider," Chris said. "He's only been here a year, right? Nobody knows where he came from, right? He's wormed his way in with Oliver, and he hates all of us because he knows we might do it too, right? He leads his soldiers away from the tannery, goes all the way up the street until we speak, and then he's right back on us. I'm telling you, it has to be Decare."
"There's only one problem," Merrick said. "Decare speaks flawless Occitan."
"Well, so do you."
"No, I speak like a clumsy foreigner. You two listen to the translations in the earpiece. I listen to what they actually say. Decare speaks like a native. He's completely fluent, and his accent exactly matches everyone else's. And Occitan is a dead language in the 20th century. There's no way he could be from our century and speak like that. He's got to be a native."
"Maybe he's a linguist."
Merrick was shaking his head. "It's not Decare," he said. "It's Guy Maligon."
"Sir Guy?"
"No question," Merrick said. "I've had my doubts about him ever since that time we were caught in the passage. Remember? We were almost perfectly silent in there. But he opens the door and catches us. He didn't even try to act surprised. He didn't draw his sword. Quite straightforward, shouting the alarm. Because he already knew we were there."
"But that's not how it happened. Sir Daniel came in," Chris said.
"Did he?" Merrick said. "I don't remember him ever coming in."
"Actually," Kate said, "I think Chris might be right. It might be Decare. Because I was in the alley between the chapel and the castle, pretty far up the chapel wall, and Decare was telling the soldiers to kill you, and I remember I was too far away to hear them clearly, but I did."
Merrick stared at her. "And then what happened?"
"Then Decare whispered to a soldier, and I couldn't hear what he said."
"Right, because he didn't have an earpiece. If he had an earpiece, you would have heard everything, including whispers, but he didn't. It's Sir Guy. Who cut Gomez's head off?
Sir Guy and his men. Who was most likely to go back to the body and retrieve the earpiece? Sir Guy. The other men were terrified of the flashing machine. Only Sir Guy was not afraid, because he knew what it was. He's from our century.
I don't think Guy was there, Chris said, when the machine was flashing.
But the clincher that it is Sir Guy, Merrick said, is that his Occitan is terrible. He sounds like a New Yorker speaking through his nose.
Well, isn't he from Middlesex? I don't think he's well born. I get the impression he was knighted for bravery, not family.
He wasn't a good enough jouster to take you out with the first lance, Merrick said. He wasn't a good enough swordsman to kill me hand to hand. I'm telling you, it's Guy de Malagon.
Well, Chris said, whoever it is, now they know we're going to the monastery.
That's right, Merrick said, stepping away from Kate and looking at her hair appraisingly. So let's go.
Kate touched her hair cautiously. She said, should I be glad I don't have a mirror?
Merrick nodded. Probably.
Do I look like a guy?
Chris and Merrick exchanged glances. Chris said,
kind of. Kind of?
Yes, you do. You look like a guy. Close enough, anyway, Merrick said. They got to their feet.
Fifteen hours, 12 minutes, 9 seconds. The heavy wooden door opened a crack. From the darkness inside, a shadowed face in a white cowl peered out at them.
God grant you growth and increase, the monk said solemnly.
God grant you health and wisdom, Merrick replied in Occitan.
What is your business?
We come to see Brother Marcel.
The monk nodded, almost as if he had been expecting them.
Certes, you may enter, the monk said. You are in good time, for he is still here.
He opened the door a little wider so they were able to pass through one at a time. They found themselves in a small stone anteroom, very dark. They smelled a fragrant odor of roses and oranges. From within the monastery itself they heard the soft sound of chanting.
You may leave your weapons there, the monk said, pointing to the corner of the room.
Good brother, I fear we cannot. Merrick said.
You have nothing to fear here, he said. Disarm or depart.
Merrick started to protest, then unbuckled his sword.
The monk glided ahead of them down a quiet hallway. The walls were bare stone. They turned a corner and went down another hallway. The monastery was very large and maze-like.
This was a Cistercian monastery. The monks wore white robes of plain cloth. The austerity of the Cistercian order stood as a deliberate reproach to the more corrupt orders of Benedictines and Dominicans. Cistercian monks were expected to keep rigid discipline in an atmosphere of severe asceticism. For centuries, the Cistercians did not permit any carved decoration on their plain buildings, nor any decorative illustrations to their manuscripts. Their diet consisted of vegetables, bread, and water, with no meats or sauces. Cots were hard, rooms were bare and cold. Every aspect of their monastic life was determinedly Spartan. But in fact, this quality of rigid discipline had...
Thwack!
Merrick turned toward the sound. They were coming into a cloister, an open court within the monastery surrounded by arched passages on three sides intended as a place of reading and contemplation.
Thwack!
Now they heard laughter, noisy shouts of men.
Thwack! Thwack!
As they came into the cloister, Merrick saw that the fountain and garden in the center had been removed. The ground was bare, hard-packed dirt. Four men, sweating in linen smocks, were standing in the dirt playing a kind of handball.
Thwack!
The ball rolled on the ground, and the men pushed and shoved each other, letting it roll. When it stopped, one man picked it up and cried, "Tenay!" and served the ball overhand, smacking it with his flat palm. The ball bounced off the side wall of the cloisters. The men yelled and jostled one another for position. Beneath the arches, monks and nobles shouted encouragement, clinking bags of gambling money in their hands. There was a long wooden board attached to one wall, and every time a ball hit that board, making a loud bonk, there were extra shouts of encouragement from the gamblers in the galleries. It took Merrick a moment to realize what he was looking at, the earliest form of tennis. Tenne, from the server's shout, meaning receive it, was a new game, invented just 25 years earlier, and it had become the instant rage of the period. Rackets and nets would come centuries later. For now, the game was a variety of handball, played by all classes of society. Children played in the streets. Among the nobility, the game was so popular that it provoked a trend to build new monasteries, which were abandoned unfinished once the cloisters had been constructed. Royal families worried that princes neglected their instruction as knights in favor of long hours on the tennis court, often playing by torchlight far into the night. Gambling was ubiquitous. King John II of France, now captive in England, had, over the years, spent a small fortune to pay his tennis debts. King John was known as John the Good, but it was said that whatever John was good at, it was certainly not tennis. Merrick said, "Do you play here often?"
"Exercise invigorates the body and sharpens the mind," the monk replied immediately. "We play in two cloisters here."
As they passed through the cloister, Merrick noticed that several of the gamblers wore robes of green trimmed in black. They were rough, grizzled men with a manner of bandits. Then they had left the cloister behind and went up a flight of stairs. Merrick said to the monk, "It appears the order makes welcome the men of Arnaud de Cerveau."
"That is sooth," the monk said, "for they shall do us a boon and return the mill to us."
"Was it taken?" Merrick asked.
"In a manner of speaking."
The monk walked to the window which overlooked the Dordogne and the mill bridge a quarter mile upstream.
"With their own hands, the monks of Saint-Mère have built the mill at the bidding of our revered architect, Brother Marcel. Marcel is much venerated in the monastery. As you know, he was architect for the former abbot, Bishop Laon. So the mill that he designed and we built is the property of this monastery, as are its fees. Yet Sir Oliver demands a mill tax to himself, though he has no just cause for it, except that his army controls this territory. Therefore my lord abbot is well pleased that Arnaud should vow to return the mill to the monastery and end the tax, and thus we are friendly to the men of Arnaud."
Chris listened to all this, thinking, "My thesis! It was all exactly as his research had shown." Although some people still thought of the Middle Ages as a backward time, Chris knew it had actually been a period of intense technological development, and in that sense, not so different from our own. In fact, the industrial mechanization that became a characteristic feature of the West first began in the Middle Ages. The greatest source of power available at the time, water power, was aggressively developed and employed to do ever more kinds of work, not only grinding grain, but fulling cloth, blacksmithing, beer mashing, woodworking, mixing mortar and cement, paper making, rope making, oil pressing, preparing dyes for cloth, and powering bellows to heat blast furnaces for steel. All over Europe, rivers were dammed and dammed again half a mile downstream. Mill boats were tethered beneath every bridge. In some places, cascades of mills, one after another, successfully used the energy of flowing water. Mills were generally operated as a monopoly, and they provided a major source of income and of conflict. Lawsuits, murders, and battles were the constant accompaniment of mill activity. And here was an example that showed...
"And yet," Merrick was saying, "I see the mill is still in the hands of Lord Oliver, for his pennant flies from the towers and his archers man the battlements."
"Oliver holds the mill bridge," the monk said, "because the bridge is close to the road at La Roque, and whoever controls the mill controls the road. But Arnaud will soon take the mill from them."
"And return it to you?"
"Indeed."
"And what will the monastery do for Arnaud in return?"
"We will bless him, of course," the monk said, and after a moment he added, "And we will pay him handsomely, too."
They passed through a scriptorium, where monks sat in rows at their easels, silently copying manuscripts. But to Merrick it looked all wrong. Instead of a meditative chant, their work was accompanied by the shouts and banging of the game in the cloister. and despite the old Cistercian proscription against illustration, many monks were painting illustrations in the corners and along the margins of manuscripts. The painters sat with an array of brushes and stone dishes of different colors. Some of the illustrations were brilliantly ornate. "This way," the monk said, and led them down a staircase and into a small sunlit courtyard. To one side, Merrick saw 8 soldiers in the colors of Arnaud standing in the sun. He noticed that they wore their swords. The monk led them toward a small house at the edge of the courtyard, and then through a door. They heard the trickle of running water and saw a fountain with a large basin. They heard chanted prayers in Latin. In the center of the room, 2 robed monks washed a naked, pale body lying on a table. "Frater Marcellus," the monk whispered, giving a slight bow. Merrick stared. It took him a moment to realize what he was seeing. Brother Marcel was dead. 14 hours, 52 minutes, 7 seconds. Their reaction gave them away. The monk could clearly see that they had not known Marcel was dead. Frowning, he took Merrick by the arm and said, "Why are you here?" "We had hoped to speak with Brother Marcel. He died last night." "How did he die?" Merrick said.
"We do not know, but as you can see, he was old."
"Our request of him was urgent," Merrick said. "Perhaps if I could see his private effects—"
"He had no private effects."
"But surely some personal articles—"
"He lived very simply."
Merrick said, "May I see his room?"
"I am sorry, that is not possible.
But I would greatly appreciate it if—"
"Brother Marcel lived in the mill. His room has been there for many years."
"Ah."
The mill was now under control of Oliver's troops. They could not go there, at least not for the moment. "But perhaps I can help you. Tell me, what was your urgent request?" the monk asked. He spoke casually, but Merrick was immediately cautious.
"It was a private matter," Merrick said. "I cannot speak of it."
"There is nothing private here," the monk said. He was edging toward the door. Merrick had the distinct feeling that he was going to raise an alarm.
"It was a request from Magister Edwardus."
"Magister Edwardus." The monk's manner completely changed. "Why did you not say so? And what are you to Magister Edwardus?"
"Faith, we are his assistants."
"Certes?"
"Indeed, it is so."
"Why did you not say it? Magister Edwardus is welcome here, for he was performing a service for the abbot when he was taken by Oliver."
"Ah."
"Come with me now at once," he said. "The abbot will wish to see you."
"But we have—"
"The abbot will wish it. Come."
Back in the sunlight, Merrick noticed how many more soldiers in green and black were now in the monastery courtyards. And these soldiers were not lounging. They were watchful, battle-ready. The abbot's house was small, made of ornately carved wood, and located in a far corner of the monastery. They were led inside to a small wood-paneled anteroom, where an older monk, hunched and heavy as a toad, sat before a closed door.
"Is my lord abbot within?"
"Faith, he is advising a penitent now."
From the adjacent room they heard a rhythmic creaking sound. "How long will he keep her at her prayers?" the monk asked.
"It may be a goodly while," the toad said. "She is recidive, and her sins are oft repeated."
"I would you make known these worthy men to our lord abbot," the monk said, "for they bring news of Edwardus to John's."
"Be assured I shall tell him," the toad said in a bored tone. But Merrick caught the gleam of sudden interest in the old man's eyes. Some meaning had registered. "It is nigh on Tursa," the toad said, glancing up at the sun. "Will your guest dine on our simple fare?" "Many thanks, but no, we shall—" Chris coughed. Kate poked Merrick in the back. Merrick said, "We shall, if it is not a great trouble." "By the grace of God, you are welcome." They were starting to leave for the dining room when a young monk ran breathlessly into the room.
"My lord Arnaud is coming. He will see the abbot at once."
The toad jumped to his feet and said to them, "Be you gone now." And he opened a side door, which was how they found themselves in a small, plain room adjacent to the abbot's quarters. The squeaking of the bed stopped. They heard the low murmur of the toad, who was speaking urgently to the abbot. A moment later, another door opened, and a woman came in,
bare-legged, hastily adjusting her clothes, her face flushed. She was extremely beautiful. When she turned, Chris saw with astonishment that it was the Lady Claire. She caught his look and said, "Why stare you thus?"
My lady.
"Squire, your countenance is most unjust. How dare you judge me? I am a gentlewoman, alone in a foreign part, with no one to champion me, to protect or guide me. Yet I must make my way to Bordeaux, 80 leagues distant, and thence to England, if I am to claim my husband's lands. That is my duty as a widow and mother, and in this time of war and tumult, I shall without hesitation do all that may be required to accomplish it." Chris was thinking that hesitation was not a part of this woman's character. He was stunned by her boldness. On the other hand, Merrick was looking at her with open admiration. He said smoothly, "Pray forgive him, lady, for he is young and often thoughtless. Circumstances change. I had need of an introduction that only the abbot could make for me. What persuasion is in my command, I use." The Lady Claire was hopping on one foot now, trying to keep her balance while pulling on her hose. She drew the hose tight, smoothed her dress, and then set her wimple on her head, tying it expertly beneath her chin, so only her face was exposed. Within moments she looked like a nun. Her manner became demure, her voice lower, softer. "Now, by happenstance, you know what I had intended no person to know. In this I am at your mercy, and I beg your silence."
"You shall have it," Merrick said, "for your affairs are none of ours."
"You shall have my silence in return," she said, "for it is evident the abbot does not wish your presence known to de Cerveul. We shall all keep our secrets. Have I your word?"
"In sooth, yes, lady," Merrick said.
"Yes, lady," Chris said.
"Yes, lady,"
Kate said. Hearing her voice, Claire frowned at Kate, then walked over to her. "Say you true?"
"Yes, lady," Kate said again.
Claire ran her hand over Kate's chest, feeling the breasts beneath the flattening cloth band. "You have cut your hair, damsel," she said. "You know that to pass as a man is punishable by death." She glanced at Chris as she said this.
"We know it," Merrick said. "You must have great dedication to your magister to give up your sex."
"My lady, I do."
"Then I pray most earnestly that you survive."
The door opened, and the toad gestured to them. "Worthies, come. My lady, pray remain. The abbot will do your bidding soon enough, but you worthies, come with me." Outside in the courtyard, Chris leaned close to Merrick and whispered, "Andre, that woman is poison." Merrick was smiling.
"I agree she has a certain spark."
"Andre, I'm telling you, you can't trust anything she says."
"Really? I thought she was remarkably straightforward," Merrick said. "She wants protection, and she is right."
Chris stared. "Protection?"
"Yes, she wants a champion," Merrick said, thoughtfully.
"A champion? What are you talking about? We have only, what, how many hours left?"
Merrick looked at his wristband. 11 hours, 10 minutes.
"So what are you talking about, a champion?"
"Oh, just thinking," Merrick said. He threw his arm over Chris's shoulder. "It's not important."
11 hours, 1 minute, 59 seconds. They were seated at a long table with many monks in a large hall, a steaming bowl of meat soup in front of them, and in the center of the table, platters piled high with vegetables and roast capons, and no one moving a muscle, but all heads bowed in prayer as the monks chanted,
"Pater noster qui es in cieli, sanctificetur nomen tuem, adveniat regnium tuem, fiat voluntas tua."
Kate kept sneaking looks at the food. The capons were steaming. They looked fat, and yellow juice flowed onto the plate. Then she noticed that the monks nearest her seemed puzzled by her silence. She should know this chant, it seemed. Beside her, Merrick was chanting loudly,
"Panem nostrem quotidianum da nobis hodi et dimitte nobis debita nostra."
She didn't understand Latin, and she couldn't join in, so she stayed silent until the final,
"Amen."
The monks all looked up, nodded to her. She braced herself. She had been fearing this moment, because they would speak to her, and she wouldn't be able to answer back. What would she do? She looked at Merrick, who seemed perfectly relaxed. Of course he would be. He spoke the language.
A monk passed a platter of beef to her, saying nothing. In fact, the entire room was silent. The food was passed without a word. There was no sound at all except for the soft clink of plates and knives. They ate in silence. She took the platter, nodding, and gave herself one large helping, then another, until she caught Merrick's disapproving glance. She handed the platter to him. From the corner of the room, a monk began to read a text in Latin, the words a kind of cadence in her ears while she ate hungrily. She was famished. She could not remember when she had enjoyed a meal more. She glanced at Merrick, who was eating with a quiet smile on his face. She turned to her soup, which was delicious, and after a moment she glanced back at Merrick. He wasn't smiling anymore. Merrick had been keeping an eye on the entrances. There were three to this long rectangular room, one to his right, one to his left, and one directly opposite them in the center of the room. Moments before, he had seen a group of soldiers in green and black gathering near the doorway to the right. They peered in, as if interested in the meal, but remained outside. Now he saw a second group of soldiers standing in the doorway directly ahead. Kate looked at him, and he leaned very close to her ear and whispered, "Left door." The monks around them shot disapproving glances. Kate looked at Merrick and gave a little nod, meaning she understood. Where did the left-hand doorway lead? There were no soldiers at that door, and the room beyond was dark. Wherever it went, they would have to risk it. He caught Chris's eye and gave a small jerk with his thumb. Time to get up. Chris nodded almost imperceptibly. Merrick pushed away his soup and started to get up, when a white-robed monk came up to him, leaned close, and whispered, "The abbot will see you now." The abbot of Saint-Mère was an energetic man in his early 30s, with the body of an athlete and the sharp eye of a merchant. His black robes were elegantly embroidered. His heavy necklace was gold, and the hand he extended to be kissed bore jewels on four fingers. He met them in a sunny courtyard and then walked side by side with Merrick, while Chris and Kate trailed behind. There were green and black soldiers everywhere. The abbot's manner was cheerful, but he had the habit of abruptly changing the subject, as if to catch the listener off guard. "I am heartfelt sorry for these soldiers," the abbot said, "but I fear intruders have entered the monastery grounds. Some men of Oliver, and until we find them we must be cautious. And my lord Arnaud has graciously offered us his protection. Have you eaten well?"
"By the grace of God and your own, very well, my lord abbot."
The abbot smiled pleasantly. "I dislike flattery," he said, "and our order forbids it."
"I shall be mindful," Merrick said.
The abbot looked at the soldiers and sighed. "So many soldiers ruin the game."
"What game is that?"
"The game, the game," he said impatiently. "Yesterday morning we went hunting and returned haveless, with not so much as a roebuck to show, and the men of Servolles had not yet arrived. Now they are here, 2,000 of them. What game they do not take, they frighten off. It will be months before the forest settle again. What news of Magister Edwardus? Tell me, for I am sore in need to have it."
Merrick frowned. The abbot did indeed appear tense, chafing to hear, but he seemed to be expecting specific information. "My lord abbot, he is in La Roque."
"Oh, with Sir Oliver?"
"Yes, my lord abbot."
"Most unfortunate. Did he give you a message for me?"
He must have seen Merrick's puzzled look.
"No?"
"My lord abbot, Edwardus gave me no message."
"Perhaps in code, some trivial or mistaken turn of phrase?"
"I am sorry," Merrick said.
"Not so sorry as I. And now he is in La Roque?"
"He is, my lord abbot."
"Sooth, I would not have it so," the abbot said, "for I think La Roque cannot be taken."
"Yet if there is a secret passage to the inside," Merrick said.
"Oh, the passage," the abbot said, giving a wave of his hand. "It will be my undoing. It is all that I hear spoken. Every man wishes to know the passage, and Arnaud more than any of them."
The magister was assisting me, searching the old documents of Marcellus. Are you certain he said nothing to you?
He said we were to seek Brother Marcel.
The abbot snorted. Certes, the secret passage was the work of Léon's assistant and scribe, who was Brother Marcel. But for the last years, old Marcel was not well in spirit. That is why we let him live in the mill. All through the day he muttered and mumbled to himself, and then of a sudden he would cry out that he saw demons and spirits, and his eyes rolled in his head, and his limbs thrashed wildly until the visions passed. The abbot shook his head. The other monks venerated him, seeing his visions as proof of piety, and not of disorder, which in truth it was. But why did the magister tell you to seek him out?
The magister said Marcel had a key.
A key? The abbot said. A key? He sounded very annoyed. Of course he had a key. He had many keys, and they are all to be found in the mill, but we cannot...
He stumbled forward, then stared with a shocked expression at Merrick. All around the courtyard, men were shouting, pointing upward. Merrick said, "My lord abbot?"
The abbot spat blood and collapsed into Merrick's arms. Merrick eased him to the ground. He felt the arrow in the abbot's back even before he saw it. More arrows whistled down and thunked, quivering in the grass beside them. Merrick looked up and saw maroon figures in the bell tower of the church firing rapidly. An arrow ripped Merrick's hat from his head. Another tore through the sleeve of his tunic. Another arrow stuck deep in the abbot's shoulder. The next arrow struck Merrick in the thigh. He felt searing, red-hot pain streak down his leg, and he lost his balance, falling back on the ground. He tried to get up, but he was dizzy, and his balance had deserted him. He fell back again as arrows whistled down all around him.
On the opposite side of the courtyard, Chris and Kate ran for cover through the rain of arrows. Kate yelled and stumbled, fell to the ground, an arrow sticking in her back. Then she scrambled up, and Chris saw it had torn through her tunic beneath her armpit, but had not struck her. An arrow skinned his leg, tearing his hose. And then they reached the covered passageway where they collapsed behind one of the arches, catching their breath. Arrows clattered off the stone walls and struck the stone arches all around them. Chris said, "You okay?" She nodded, panting. "Where's Merrick?" Chris got to his feet, peered cautiously around the pillar.
"Oh, no," he said, and he started to run down the corridor.
Merrick staggered to his feet, saw that the abbot was still alive.
"Forgive me," Merrick said as he lifted the abbot onto his shoulder and carried him away to the corner.
The soldiers in the courtyard loosed answering volleys at the bell tower. Fewer arrows were coming down at them now. Merrick took the abbot behind the arches of the covered passageway and placed him on his side on the ground. The abbot pulled the arrow out of his own shoulder and threw it aside. The effort left him gasping.
"My back. Back."
Merrick turned him over gently. The shaft in his back pulsed with each heartbeat.
"My lord, do you wish me to pull it?"
"No."
The abbot flung a desperate arm over Merrick's neck, pulling him close.
"Not yet. A priest. Priest."
His eyes rolled. A priest was running toward them.
"He comes now, my lord abbot."
The abbot appeared relieved by this, but he still held Merrick in a strong grip. His voice was low, almost a whisper.
"The key to La Roque."
"Yes, my lord."
"Room."
Merrick waited.
"What room, my lord? What room?"
"Ah, no,"
the abbot said, shaking his head as if to clear it.
"Ah, no will be angry. Room."
And he released his grip. Merrick pulled the arrow from his back and helped him to lie back to the floor.
"Every time he would make, told no one. So, Arnaud."
He closed his eyes. The monk pushed between them, speaking quickly in Latin, removing the abbot's slippers, placing a bottle of oil on the ground. He began to administer the last rites. Leaning against one of the cloister pillars, Merrick pulled the arrow out of his thigh. It had struck him glancingly, and it was not as deep as he had thought.
There was only an inch of blood on the shaft. He dropped the arrow to the ground just as Chris and Kate came up. They looked at his leg and at the arrow. He was bleeding. Kate pulled up her doublet and tore a strip from the bottom of her linen undershirt with her dagger. She tied it around Merrick's thigh as an impromptu bandage. Merrick said, "It's not that bad." "Then it won't hurt you to have it," she said. "Can you walk?" "Of course I can walk," Merrick said. "You're pale." "I'm fine," he said, and moved away from the pillar, looking into the courtyard. Four soldiers lay on the ground, which was pincushioned with arrows. The other soldiers had departed. No one was shooting arrows at the bell tower any longer. Smoke billowed from the high windows. On the opposite side of the courtyard, they saw more smoke, thick and dark, coming from the area of the refectory. The whole monastery was starting to burn. "We need to find that key," Merrick said.
"But it's in his room."
"I'm not sure about that." Merrick had remembered that one of the last things Elsie, the graphologist, had said to him back at the project site had to do with a key, and some word that she was puzzled by. He couldn't remember the details. He had been worried about the professor at the time, but he remembered clearly enough that Elsie had been looking at one of the parchment sheets from the pile that had been found in the monastery, the same pile that had contained the professor's note. And Merrick knew where to find those parchments. They hurried down the corridor toward the church. Some of the stained glass windows had been broken and smoke issued out. From the interior, they heard men shouting, and a moment later, a party of soldiers burst through the doors. Merrick turned on his heel, leading them back the way they had come. "What are we doing?" Chris said. "Looking for the door."
"What door?"
Merrick darted left along a cloistered corridor and then left again through a very narrow opening that brought them into a tight space, a kind of storeroom area. It was lit by a torch. There was a wooden trap door in the floor. He flung it open, and they saw steps going down into darkness. He grabbed a torch, and they all went down the steps. Chris was last, closing the trapdoor behind him. He descended the stairs into a dank, dark chamber. The torch sputtered in the cool air. By its flickering light, they saw huge casks, 6 feet in diameter, running along the wall. They were in a wine cellar. "You know the soldiers will find this place soon enough," Merrick said. He led them through several rooms of casks, moving without hesitation. Following behind him, Kate said, "Do you know where you're going?" "Don't you?" he said. But she didn't. She and Chris stayed close behind Merrick, wanting to be in the comforting circle of light from the torch. Now they were passing tombs, small indentations in the wall where bodies rested, their shrouds rotting away. Sometimes they saw the tops of skulls, with bits of hair still clinging. Sometimes they saw feet, the bones partially exposed. They heard the faint squeak of rats in the darkness. Kate shivered. Merrick continued on, until at last he stopped abruptly in a chamber that was nearly empty. "Why are we stopping?" she said.
"Don't you know?" Merrick said.
She looked around, then realized that she was in the same underground chamber she had crawled into several days before. There was the same sarcophagus of a knight, now with the lid on the coffin. Along another wall was a crude wooden table, where sheets of oilskin were stacked and manuscript bundles were tied with hemp. To one side was a low stone wall, on which stood a single manuscript bundle, and the glint of the lens from the professor's eyeglasses.
"He must have lost it yesterday," Kate said. "The soldiers must have captured him down here."
"Probably."
She watched as Merrick started going through the bundled sheets one after another. He quickly found the professor's message, then turned back to the preceding sheet. He frowned, peering at it in the torchlight.
"What is it?" she said.
"It's a description," he said, "of an underground river, and here it is."
He pointed to the side of the manuscript, where a notation in Latin had been scrawled.
"It says, Marcellus has the key," he pointed with his finger, "and then it says something about a door or opening and large feet."
"Large feet?"
"Wait a minute," he said. "No, that's not it."
What Elsie had said was coming back to him now.
"It says, feet of a giant's feet."
"A giant's feet," she said, looking doubtfully at him. "Are you sure you have that right?"
"That's what it says."
"And what's this?" she said. Beneath his finger there were two words, one arranged above the other.
"Decide?"
Vivix. I remember, Merrick said. Elsie said this was a new word for her. Vivix. But she didn't say anything about decide, and that doesn't even look like Latin to me. And it's not Occitan or Old French. With his dagger, he cut a corner from the parchment, then scratched the two words into the material, folded it, and slipped it into his pocket.
But what does it mean? Kate said.
Merrick shook his head. No idea at all.
It was added in the margins, she said. Maybe it doesn't mean anything. Maybe it's a doodle or an accounting or something like that.
I doubt it. They must have doodled back then. I know, but this doesn't look like a doodle, Kate. This is a serious notation.
He turned back to the manuscript, running his finger along the text.
Okay, okay, it says here, Transitus occultus incipit. The passage starts, Propra ad capellam viridem sive capellam mortis. At the Green Chapel, also known as the Chapel of Death, and...
The Green Chapel? She said in an odd voice.
Merrick nodded. That's right. But it doesn't say where the chapel is. He sighed. If the passage really connects to the limestone caves, it could be anywhere.
No, Andre, she said. It's not.
What do you mean?
I mean, she said, that I know where the Green Chapel is.
Kate said, it was marked on the survey charts for the Dordogne project. It's a ruin, just outside the project area. I remember wondering why it hadn't been included in the project because it was so close. On the chart, it was marked Chapelle Verte Morte, and I thought it meant the Chapel of Green Death. I remember because it sounded like something out of Edgar Allan Poe. Do you remember where it is exactly?
Not exactly, except that it's in the forest about a kilometer north of Bézanac.
Then it's possible, Merrick said. A kilometer-long tunnel is possible.
From behind them, they heard the sound of soldiers coming down into the cellar.
Time to go.
He led them to the left into a corridor where the staircase was located. When Kate had seen it before, it disappeared into a mound of earth. Now it ran straight up to a wooden trap door. Merrick climbed the stairs, put his shoulder to the door. It opened easily. They saw gray sky and smoke. Merrick went through and they followed after him. They emerged in an orchard, the fruit trees in neat rows, the spring leaves a bright green. They ran ahead through the trees, eventually arriving at the monastery wall. It was 12 feet tall, too high to climb, but they climbed the trees, then dropped over the monastery wall, landing outside. Directly ahead, they saw a section of dense, uncleared forest. They ran toward it, once again entering the dark canopy of the trees.
9 hours, 57 minutes, 2 seconds. In the ITC laboratory, David Stern stepped away from the prototype machine. He looked at the small, taped-together electronic bundle that he had been assembling and testing for the last 5 hours.
That's it, he said. That'll send them a message.
It was now night in the lab. The glass windows were dark. He said,
What time is it, back there?
Gordon counted on his fingers.
They arrived about 8 in the morning. It's been 27 hours elapsed time, so it's now 11 in the morning, the following day.
Okay, that should be okay.
Stern had managed to build this electronic communications device, despite Gordon's 2 strong arguments that such a thing could not be done. Gordon said that you couldn't send a message back there because you didn't know where the machine would land. Statistically, the chances were overwhelming that the machine would land where the team wasn't, so they would never see a message. The second problem was that you had no way of knowing whether they had received the message or not. But Stern had solved both those objections in an extremely simple way. His bundle contained an earpiece transmitter receiver, identical to the ones the team was already wearing, and 2 small tape recorders. The first tape recorder transmitted a message. The second recorded any incoming message to the earpiece transmitter. The whole contraption was, as Gordon admiringly termed it, a multiverse answering machine. Stern recorded a message that said, This is David. You have now been out for 27 hours. Don't try to come back until 32 hours. Then we'll be ready for you at this end. Meanwhile, tell us if you're all right. Just speak,
and it'll be recorded. Goodbye for now. See you soon. Stern listened to the message one final time, then said, "Okay, let's send it back." Gordon pushed buttons on the control panel. The machine began to hum and was bathed in blue light. Hours earlier, when he had begun working on this message machine, Stern's only concern was that his friends back there might not know they couldn't return. As a result, he could imagine them getting into a jam, perhaps being attacked from all sides, and calling for the machine at the last instant, assuming they could come home at once. So Stern thought they should be told that for the moment, they couldn't come back. That had been his original concern, but now there was a second, even greater concern. The air in the cave had been cleared for about 14 hours now. Teams of workers were back inside, rebuilding the transit pad. The control booth had been continuously monitored for many hours, and there had been no field bucks, which meant there had been no attempt to come back. And Stern had the feeling, of course nobody would say anything outright, least of all Gordon, but he had the feeling that people in ITC thought that to go more than 20 hours without a field buck was a bad sign. He sensed that a large faction inside ITC believed the team was already dead. So interest in Stern's machine was not so much about whether a message could be sent as whether one would be received, because that would be evidence that the team was still alive. Stern had rigged the machine with an antenna, and he made a little ratchet device that turned the flexible antenna to different angles and repeated the outgoing message three times. So there would be three chances for the team to respond. After that, the entire machine would automatically return to the present, just as it had when they were using the camera. "Here we go," Gordon said. With flashes of laser light, the machine began to shrink into the floor. It was an uncomfortable wait. 10 minutes later, the machine returned. Cold vapor whispered across the floor as Stern removed his electronic bundle, tore the tape away, and started to play back. The outgoing message was played. There was no response. The outgoing message was played again. Again, there was no response. The crackle of static, but nothing. Gordon was staring at Stern, his face expressionless. Stern said, "There could be lots of explanations." "Of course there could, David." The outgoing message was played a third time. Stern held his breath. More static crackling, and then, in the quiet of the laboratory, he heard Kate's voice say, "Did you guys just hear something?"
"Merrick, what are you talking about?"
"Chris, geez, Kate, turn your earpiece off."
"Kate, but..."
"Merrick, turn it off."
More static. No more voices. But the point was made.
"They're alive," Stern said.
"They certainly are," Gordon said. "Let's go see how they're doing at the transit pad."
Doniger was walking around in his office, mouthing the words to his speech, practicing his hand gestures, his turns. He had a reputation as a compelling, even charismatic speaker, but Kramer knew that it didn't come naturally. Rather, it was the result of long preparation, the moves, the phrasing, the gestures. Doniger left nothing to chance. At one time, Kramer had been perplexed by this behavior. His endless, obsessive rehearsal for any public appearances seemed odd for a man who, in most situations, didn't give a damn how he came across to others. Eventually, she realized that Doniger enjoyed public speaking because it was so overtly manipulative. He was convinced he was smarter than anyone else, and a persuasive speech, "They'll never know what hit him," was another way to prove it. Now Doniger paced, using Kramer as an audience of one. "We are all ruled by the past, although no one understands it. No one recognizes the power of the past," he said with a sweep of his hand. "But if you think about it, the past has always been more important than the present. The present is like a coral island that sticks above the water, but is built upon millions of dead corals under the surface that no one sees. In the same way, our everyday world is built upon millions and millions of events and decisions that occurred in the past, and what we add in the present is trivial.
A teenager has breakfast, then goes to the store to buy the latest CD of a new band. The kid thinks he lives in a modern moment, but who has defined what a band is? Who defined a store? Who defined a teenager? Or breakfast, to say nothing of all the rest, the kid's entire social setting, family, school, clothing, transportation, legal, and government. None of this has been decided in the present. Most of it was decided hundreds of years ago. 500 years, 1,000 years, this kid is sitting on top of a mountain that is the past, and he never notices it. He is ruled by what he never sees, never thinks about, doesn't know. It is a form of coercion that is accepted without question. This same kid is skeptical of other forms of control, parental restrictions, commercial messages, government laws, but the invisible rule of the past, which decides nearly everything in his life, goes unquestioned. This is real power. Power that can be taken and used. For just as the present is ruled by the past, so is the future. And that is why I say the future belongs to the past. And the reason? Doniger broke off, annoyed. Kramer's cell phone was ringing, and she answered it. He paced back and forth, trying one hand gesture, then another. Finally, Kramer hung up the phone, looked at him. He said, "Yes, what is it?" "That was Gordon. They're alive, Bob." "Are they back yet?" "No, but we got a recorded message of their voices. All three of them are alive."
"A message? Who figured out how to do that?"
"Stern."
"Really? Maybe he's not as stupid as I thought. We should hire him."
He paused.
"So, are you telling me we'll get them back after all?"
"No, I'm not sure about that."
"What's the problem?"
"They're keeping their earpieces turned off."
"They are? But why?" "The earpiece batteries have plenty of power to go 37 hours. There's no reason to keep them off."
He stared.
"Do you think... you think it's him? You think it's Deckard?"
"Maybe. Yes."
"How? It's been over a year. Deckard must be dead by now. Remember the way he kept picking fights with everybody?"
"Well, something made them turn off their earpieces."
"I don't know," Doniger said. "Rob had too many transcription errors, and he was out of control. Hell, he was going to jail."
"Yes, for beating up some guy in a bar he'd never seen before," Kramer said. "The police report said Deckard hit him 52 times with a metal chair. The guy was in a coma for a year, and Rob was definitely going to jail. That's why he volunteered to go back one more time."
"If Deckard's still alive," Doniger said, "then they're still in trouble."
"Yes, Bob, they're still in plenty of trouble."
9 hours, 57 minutes, 2 seconds. Back in the cool darkness of the forest, Merrick drew in a rough map in the dirt with a stick. "Right now we're here, behind the monastery. The mill is over here, about a quarter mile from where we are. There's a checkpoint we have to get past."
"Uh-huh," Chris said.
"And then we have to get into the mill."
"Somehow," Chris said.
"Right. After that we have the key, so we go to the Green Chapel. Which is where, Kate?" She took the stick and drew a square. "If this is Laroque, on top of the cliff, then there's a forest to the north. The road's about here. I think the chapel is not very far. Maybe here."
"A mile? 2 miles?"
"Say 2 miles." Merrick nodded.
"Well, that's all easy enough,"
Chris said, standing and wiping the dirt from his hands. "All we have to do is get past the armed checkpoint, into the fortified mill, then go to some chapel, and not get killed on the way. Let's get started." Leaving the forest behind, they moved through a landscape of destruction. Flames leapt above the monastery of Saint-Mère, and clouds of smoke darkened the sun. Black ash covered the ground, fell on their faces and shoulders, and thickened the air. They tasted grit in their mouths. Across the river they could just make out the dark outline of Castelgar, now a blackened, smoking ruin on the hillside. Walking through this desolation, they saw no one else for a long time. They passed one farmhouse to the west of the monastery, where an elderly man lay on the ground, with 2 arrows in his chest. From inside they heard the sound of a baby crying. Looking inside they saw a woman, hacked to death, lying face down by the fire, and a young boy of 6 staring at the sky, his innard sliced open. They did not see the baby, but the sound seemed to be coming from a blanket in the corner. Kate started toward it,
but Merrick held her back.
Don't.
They continued on. The smoke drifted across an empty landscape, abandoned huts, untended fields. Aside from the farmhouse with its slaughtered inhabitants, they saw almost no one else.
Where is everybody? Chris said.
They're all in the woods, Merrick said. They have huts there and underground shelters. They know what to do.
In the woods? How do they live?